Kaladin looked at his brother with his innocent face and affable nature. He hadn't lost either, though he was now into his teenage years. How is it you can always smile? Kaladin thought. It's dreadful outside, your master treats you like Krem, and your family is slowly being strangled by the city lord, and yet you smile. How, Tien? And why is it that you make me want to smile, too?
Father spent another of the spheres, Tien, Kaladin found himself saying. Each time their father was forced to do that, he seemed to grow a little more wan, stand a little less tall. Those spheres were done these days, no light in them. You couldn't infuse spheres during the weeping. They all ran out eventually.
There are plenty more, Tien said.
Roshon is trying to wear us down, Kaladin said. Bit by bit, smother us.
It's not as bad as it seems, Kaladin, his brother said, reaching up to hold his arm. Things are never as bad as they seem. You'll see.
So many objections rose in his mind, but Tien's smile banished them. There, in the midst of the most dreariest part of the year, Kaladin felt for a moment he had glimpsed sunshine. He could swear he felt things grow brighter around him, the storm retreating a shade, the sky lightening. Their mother rounded the back of the building. She looked up at them, as if amused to find them both sitting on the roof in the rain. She stepped onto the lower portion. A small group of haspers clung to the stone there. The small two-shelled creatures proliferated during the weeping. They seemed to grow out of nowhere, much like their cousins, the tiny snails, scattered all across the stone.
"What are you two talking about?" she asked, walking up and sitting down with them. Hesina rarely acted like the other mothers in town. Sometimes that bothered Kaladin. Shouldn't she have sent them into the house or something, complaining that they'd catch a cold? No, she just sat down with them, wearing a brown leather raincoat.
"Kaladin's worried about Father spending the spheres," Tien said.
"Oh, I wouldn't worry about that," she replied. "We'll get you to Carbranth. You'll be old enough to leave in 2 more months."
"You two should come with me," Cal said. "And Father, too."
"And leave the town?" Tien said, as if he'd never considered that possibility.
"But I like it here."
Hesina smiled.
"What?" Kaladin said.
"Most young men your age are trying everything they can to be rid of their parents. I can't go off and leave you here. We're a family."
"He's trying to strangle us," Kaladin said, glancing at Tien.
Talking with his brother had made him feel a lot better, but his objections were still there.
"Nobody pays for healing, and I know nobody will pay you for work anymore. What kind of value does Father get for those spheres he spends anyway? Vegetables at 10 times the regular price? Molded grain at double?"
Hesina smiled.
"Observant.
Father taught me to notice details. The eyes of a surgeon."
"Well," she said, eyes twinkling, "did your surgeon's eyes notice the first time we spent one of the spheres?"
"Sure," Kaladin said. "It was the day after the hunting accident. Father had to buy new cloth to make bandages."
"And did we need new bandages?"
"Well, no. But you know how Father is. He doesn't like it when we start to run even a little low."
"And so he spent one of those spheres," Hesina said, "that he'd hoarded for months and months, butting heads with the city lord over them.
Not to mention going to such lengths to steal them in the first place," Kaladin thought. "But you know all about that." He glanced at Tien, who was watching the sky again. So far as Cal knew, his brother hadn't discovered the truth yet.
"So your father resisted so long," Hesina said, "only to finally break and spend a sphere on some cloth bandages we wouldn't need for months."
She had a point. Why had his father suddenly decided to?
"He's letting Roshon think he's winning," Kaladin said with surprise, looking back at her.
Hesina smiled slyly.
"Roshon would have found a way to get retribution eventually,"
It wouldn't have been easy. Your father ranks high as a citizen and has the right of inquest. He did save Rishon's life, and many could testify to the severity of Riller's wounds. But Rishon would have found a way, unless he felt he'd broken us.
Kaladin turned toward the mansion. Though it was hidden by the shroud of rain, he could just make out the tents of the army camped on the field below. What would it be like to live as a soldier, often exposed to storms and rain, to winds and tempests? Once Kaladin would have been intrigued, but the life of a spearman had no call for him now. His mind was filled with diagrams of muscles and memorized lists of symptoms and diseases.
"We'll keep spending the spheres," Hasina said, "one every few weeks. Partially to live, though my family has offered supplies. More to keep Rishon thinking that we're bending. And then we send you away. Unexpectedly. You'll be gone, the spheres safely in the hands of the Ardents to use as a stipend during your years of study."
Kaladin blinked in realization. They weren't losing. They were winning.
"Think of it, Kaladin," Tien said. "You live in one of the grandest cities in the world. It will be so exciting. You'll be a man of learning, like father. You'll have clerks to read to you from any book you want."
Kaladin pushed wet hair off his forehead. Tien made it sound a lot grander than he'd been thinking. Of course, Tien could make a creme-filled puddle sound grand.
"That's true," his mother said, still staring upward. "You could learn mathematics, history, politics, tactics, the sciences."
"Aren't those things women learn?" Kaladin said, frowning.
"Light-eyed women study them, but there are male scholars as well, if not as many."
"All this to become a surgeon?"
"You wouldn't have to become a surgeon. Your life is your own, son. If you take the path of a surgeon, we will be proud. But don't feel that you need to live your father's life for him."
She looked down at Kaladin, blinking rainwater from her eyes.
"What else would I do?" Kaladin said, stupefied. "There are many professions open to men with a good mind and training. If you really wish to study all the arts, you could become an Ardent, or perhaps a storm warden."
"Storm warden." He reached by reflex for the prayer sewn to his left sleeve, waiting for the day he'd need to burn it for aid.
"They seek to predict the future."
"It's not the same thing."
"You'll see. There are so many things to explore, so many places your mind could go. The world is changing. My family's most recent letter describes amazing fabrials like pens that can write across great distances. It might not be long before men are taught to read."
"I'd never want to learn something like that," Kaladin said, aghast, glancing at Tien. Was their own mother really saying these things? But then she'd always been like this. Free, both with her mind and her tongue. Yet to become a storm warden. They studied the high storms. Predicted them, yes, but learned about them and their mysteries. They studied the winds themselves.
"No," Kaladin said. "I want to be a surgeon. Like my father."
Hasina smiled.
"If that's what you choose, then, as I said, we will be proud of you. But father and I just want you to know that you can choose."
They sat like that for some time, letting rainwater soak them. Kaladin kept searching those gray clouds, wondering what it was that Tien found so interesting in them. Eventually, he heard splashing below, and Liren's face appeared at the side of the house.
"What in the—" he said. "All three of you? What are you doing up here?"
"Feasting,"
Kaladin's mother said nonchalantly.
"On what?"
"On irregularity, dear," she said.
Liren sighed.
"Dear, you can be very odd, you know.
And didn't I just say that?"
"Point. Well, come on. There's a gathering in the square."
Hasina frowned. She rose and walked down the slope of the roof. Kaladin glanced at Tien, and the two of them stood. Kaladin stuffed the wooden horse in his pocket and picked his way down, careful on the slick rock, his shoes squishing. Cool water ran down Kaladin's cheeks as he stepped off onto the ground. They followed Liren toward the square. Kaladin's father looked worried, and he walked with the beaten-down slouch he was prone to lately. Maybe it was an affectation to fool Rishon, but Kaladin suspected there was some truth to it. His father didn't like having to give up those spheres, even if it was part of a ruse. It was too much like giving in. Ahead, a crowd was gathering at the town square, everyone holding umbrellas or wearing cloaks.
"What is it, Liren?" Hesina asked, sounding anxious.
"Rishon is going to put in an appearance," Liren said. "He asked Weber to gather everyone. Full town meeting."
"In the rain?" Kaladin asked. "Couldn't he have waited for light day?"
Liren didn't reply. The family walked in silence, even Tien growing solemn. They passed some rain spren standing in puddles, glowing with a faint blue light, shaped like ankle-high melting candles with no flame. They rarely appeared except during the weeping. They were said to be the souls of raindrops, glowing blue rods, seeming to melt but never growing smaller, a single blue eye at their tops. The townspeople were mostly assembled, gossiping in the rain, by the time Kaladin's family arrived. Jost and Nagat were there, though neither waved to Kaladin. It had been years since they'd been anything resembling friends. Kaladin shivered. His parents called this town home, and his father refused to leave, but it felt less and less like home by the day.
"I'll be leaving it soon," he thought, eager to walk out of Hearthstone and leave these small-minded people behind.
To go to a place where light eyes were men and women of honor and beauty, worthy of the high station given them by the Almighty. Rishon's carriage approached. It had lost much of its luster during his years in Hearthstone, the golden paint flaking off, the dark wood chipped by road gravel. As the carriage pulled into the square, Weber and his boys finally got a small canopy erected. The rain had strengthened, and drops hit the cloth with a hollow drumming sound. The air smelled different with all of these people around. Up on the roof it had been fresh and clean. Now it seemed muggy and humid. The carriage door opened. Rishon had gained more weight, and his light-eyes suit had been retailored to fit his increased girth. He wore a wooden peg on his right stump, hidden by the cuff of his trouser, and his gait was stiff as he climbed out of the carriage and ducked beneath the canopy, grumbling. He hardly seemed the same person, with that beard and wet stringy hair. But his eyes, they were the same. More beady now because of the fuller cheeks, but still seething as he studied the crowd. As if he had been hit with a rock when he wasn't looking and now searched for the culprit. Was Laurel inside the carriage? Someone else moved inside, climbing out, but it turned out to be a lean man with a clean-shaven face and light tan eyes. The dignified man wore a neatly pressed green formal military uniform and had a sword at his hip. High Marshal Amaram? He certainly looked impressive, with that strong figure and square face. The difference between him and Rishon was striking. Finally, Laurel did appear, wearing a light yellow dress of an antique fashion, with a flaring skirt and thick bodice. She glanced up at the rain, then waited for a footman to hurry over with an umbrella. Kaladin felt his heart thumping. They hadn't spoken since the day she'd humiliated him in Rishon's mansion. And yet, she was gorgeous. As she had grown through her adolescence, she had gotten prettier and prettier. Some might find that dark hair sprinkled with foreigner blonde to be unappealing for its indication of mixed blood, but to Kaladin it was alluring. Beside Kaladin, his father stiffened, cursing softly.
"What?"
Tien asked from beside Kaladin, craning to see.
"Laurel,"
Kaladin's mother said.
She's wearing a bride's prayer on her sleeve.
Kaladin started, seeing the white cloth with its blue glyph pair sewn onto the sleeve of her dress. She'd burn it when the engagement was formally announced. But who? Riller was dead.
I'd heard rumors of this, Kaladin's father said. It appears Rishon wasn't willing to part with the connections she offers.
Him? Kaladin asked, stunned. Rishon himself was marrying her?
Others in the crowd had begun speaking as they noticed the prayer.
Light eyes marry much younger women all the time, Kaladin's mother said. For them, marriages are often about securing house loyalty.
Him? Kaladin asked again, incredulous, stepping forward.
We have to stop it. We have to...
Kaladin, his father said sharply.
But
it is their affair, not ours.
Kaladin fell silent, feeling the larger raindrops hit his head, the smaller ones blowing by as mist.
The water ran through the square and pooled in depressions. Near Kaladin, a rain spren sprang up, forming as if out of the water. It stared upward, unblinking.
Rishon leaned on his cane and nodded to Natir, his steward. The man was accompanied by his wife, a stern-looking woman named Alaxia. Natir clapped his slender hands to quiet the crowd, and soon the only sound was that of the soft rain.
Bright Lord Amaram, Rishon said, nodding to the light-eyed man in the uniform. Is Absendi our High Marshal of our princedom? He is in command of defending our borders while the King and Bright Lord Sadius are away.
Kaladin nodded. Everyone knew of Amaram. He was far more important than most military men who passed through Hearthstone. Amaram stepped forward to speak.
You have a fine town here, Amaram said to the gathered dark eyes.
He had a strong, deep voice.
Thank you for hosting me.
Kaladin frowned, glancing at the other townspeople. They seemed as confused as he by the statement.
Normally, Amaram said, I would leave this task to one of my subordinate officers. But as I was visiting with my cousin, I decided to come down in person. It is not so onerous a task that I need delegate it.
Excuse me, Bright Lord, said Callens, one of the farmers.
But what duty is that?
Why, recruitment, good farmer, Amaram said, nodding to Alaxia, who stepped forward with a sheet of paper strapped to a board.
The king took most of our armies with him on his quest to fulfill the Vengeance Pact. My forces are undermanned, and it has become necessary to recruit young men from each town or village we pass. I do this with volunteers whenever possible.
The townspeople fell still. Boys talked of running off to the army, but few of them would actually do it. Hearthstone's duty was to provide food.
My fighting is not as glorious as the War for Vengeance, Amaram said, but it is our sacred duty to defend our lands. This tour will be for 4 years, and upon completing your duty, you will receive a war bonus equal to 1/10 your total wages. You may then return, or you may sign up for further duty. Distinguish yourself and rise to a high rank, and it could mean an increase of 1 non for you and your children. Are there any volunteers?
I'll go, Jost said, stepping forward.
Me too,
Avery added.
Jost,
Jost's mother said, grabbing his arm.
The crops.
Your crops are important, Dark Woman, Amaram said. But not nearly as important as the defense of our people. The king sends back riches from the plundered plains, and the gemstones he has captured can provide food for Alethkar in emergency. You two are both welcome. Are there any others?
3 more boys from the town stepped forward, and 1 older man, Harl, who had lost his wife to the scar fever. He was the man whose daughter Kaladin hadn't been able to save after her fall.
Excellent, Amaram said. Are there any others?
The townspeople were still. Oddly so. Many of the boys Kaladin had heard talk so often about joining the army looked away. Kaladin felt his heart beating, and his leg twitched as if itching to propel him forward. No. He was to be a surgeon. Liren looked at him, and his dark brown eyes displayed hints of deep concern. But when Kaladin didn't make any moves forward, he relaxed.
Very well,
Amaram said, nodding to Rishon.
We will need your list after all.
List?
Liren asked loudly. Amaram glanced at him.
The need of our army is great, Darkborn. I will take volunteers first, but the army must be replenished. As city lord, my cousin has the duty and honor of deciding which men to send.
Read the first four names, Alaxia, Rishon said, and the last one.
Alaxia looked down at her list, speaking with a dry voice.
Egil, son of Marf. Call, son of Taleb.
Kaladin looked up at Liren with apprehension.
He can't take you, Liren said. We're of the second non and provide an essential function to the town. I as surgeon, you as my only apprentice. By the law, we are exempt from conscription. Rishon knows it.
Abrin, son of Arafik,
Alaxia continued.
Jorna, son of Lotes.
She hesitated, then looked up.
Tien, son of Liren.
There was a stillness across the square. Even the rain seemed to hesitate for a moment. Then all eyes turned toward Tien. The boy looked dumbfounded. Liren was immune as town surgeon, Kaladin immune as his apprentice. But not Tien. He was a carpenter's third apprentice, not vital, not immune. Hesina gripped Tien tightly.
No!
Liren stepped in front of them, defensive. Kaladin stood stunned, looking at Rishon. Smiling, self-satisfied Rishon.
We took his son, Kaladin realized, meeting those beady eyes. This is his revenge.
I,
Tien said.
The military?
For once he seemed to lose his confidence, his optimism. His eyes opened wide and he grew very pale. He fainted when he saw blood. He hated fighting. He was still small and spindly despite his age.
He's too young,
Liren declared. Their neighbors sidled away, leaving Liren's family to stand alone in the rain. Amaram frowned.
In the cities, youths as young as 8 and 9 are accepted into the military.
Light-eyed sons,
Liren said.
To be trained as officers. They aren't sent into battle.
Amaram frowned more deeply. He stepped out into the rain, walking up to the family.
How old are you, son? He asked Tien.
He's 13,
Liren said. Amaram glanced at him.
The surgeon. I've heard of you.
He sighed, glancing back at Rishon.
I haven't the time to engage in your petty small-town politics, cousin. Isn't there another boy that will do?
It is my choice,
Rishon insisted. Given me by the dictates of the law, I send those the town can spare.
Well, that boy is the first one we can spare.
Liren stepped forward, eyes full of anger. High Marshal Amaram caught him by the arm.
Do not do something you would regret, Darkborn. Rishon has acted according to the law.
You hid behind the law, sneering at me, surgeon,
Rishon called to Liren.
Well, now it turns against you. Keep those spheres. The look on your face at this moment is worth the price of every one of them.
I,
Tien said again. Kaladin had never seen the boy so terrified. Kaladin felt powerless. The crowd's eyes were on Liren, standing with his arm in the grip of the light-eyed general, locking his gaze with Rishon.
I'll make the latter runner boy for a year or two, Amaram promised. He won't be in combat. It is the best I can do. Every body is needed in these times.
Liren slumped, then bowed his head. Rishon laughed, motioning Laurel toward the carriage. She didn't glance at Kaladin as she climbed back in.
Roshon followed, and though he was still laughing, his expression had grown hard, lifeless, like the dull clouds above. He had his revenge, but his son was still dead, and he was still stuck in Hearthstone. Amaram regarded the crowd.
The recruits may bring 2 changes of clothing and up to 3 stone weights of other possessions. They will be weighed. Report to the army in 2 hours and ask for Sergeant Hav.
He turned and followed Roshon. Tien stared after him, pale as a whitewashed building. Kaladin could see his terror at leaving his family. His brother, the one who always made him smile when it rained. It was physically painful for Kaladin to see him so scared. It wasn't right. Tien should smile. That was who he was. He felt the wooden horse in his pocket. Tien always brought him relief when he felt pained. Suddenly, it occurred to him that there was something he could do in turn. It's time to stop hiding in the room when someone else holds up the globe of light, Kaladin thought. It's time to be a man.
Right, Lord Amaram,
Kaladin yelled. The general hesitated, standing on the step stool into the carriage, 1 foot in the door. He glanced over his shoulder.
I want to take Tien's place, Kaladin said.
Not allowed, Roshon said from inside the carriage. The law says I may choose.
Amaram nodded grimly.
Then what if you take me as well, Kaladin said. Can I volunteer?
That way, at least, Tien wouldn't be alone.
Kaladin,
Hesina said, grabbing him on one arm.
It is allowed, Amaram said. I will not turn away any soldier, son. If you want to join, you are welcome.
Kaladin, no, Lirin said. Don't both of you go. Don't.
Kaladin looked at Tien, the boy's face wet beneath his wide-brimmed hat. He shook his head, but his eyes seemed hopeful.
I volunteer, Kaladin said, turning back to Amaram. I'll go. Then you have 2 hours, Amaram said, climbing into the carriage. Same possession allotment as the others.
The carriage door shut, but not before Kaladin got a glimpse of an even more satisfied Roshon. Rattling, the vehicle splashed away, dropping a sheet of water from its roof.
Why?
Lirin said, turning back to Kaladin, his voice ragged.
Why have you done this to me? After all of our plans?
Kaladin turned to Tien. The boy took his arm.
Thank you,
Tien whispered.
Thank you, Kaladin. Thank you. I've lost both of you,
Lirin said hoarsely, splashing away.
Storm it. Both of you.
He was crying. Kaladin's mother was crying too. She clutched Tien again.
Father,
Kaladin said, turning, amazed at how confident he felt. Lirin paused, standing in the rain, 1 foot in a puddle where rain spren clustered. They inched away from him like vertical slugs.
In 4 years I will bring him home safely, Kaladin said. I promise it by the storms and the Almighty's 10th name itself. I will bring him back. I promise.
Shadesmar 45. Shadesmar. Yelignar, called Blightwind, was one that could speak like a man, though often his voice was accompanied by the wails of those he consumed. The unmade were obviously fabrications of folklore. Curiously, most were not considered individuals, but instead personifications of kinds of destruction. This quote is from Traxel, line 33, considered a primary source, though I doubt its authenticity. They are an oddly welcoming group, these wild parshmen, Shallan read. It was King Gavilar's account again, recorded a year before his murder. It has now been nearly 5 months since our first meeting. Dalinar continues to pressure me to return to our homeland, insisting that the expedition has stretched too long. The Parshmen promise that they will lead me on a hunt for a great-shelled beast they call an Ulomas-Vara, which my scholars say translates roughly to Monster of the Chasms. If their descriptions are accurate, these creatures have large gem hearts, and one of their heads would make a truly impressive trophy. They also speak of their terrible gods, and we think they must be referring to several particularly large chasm great shells. We are amazed to find religion among these Parshmen. The mounting evidence of a complete Parshmen society with civilization, culture, and a unique language is astounding. My storm wardens have begun calling this people the Parshendi. It is obvious this group is very different from our ordinary servant Parshmen, and may not even be the same race, despite the skin patterns. Perhaps they are distant cousins, as different from ordinary Parshmen as Alethi axhounds are from the Selai breed. The Parshendi have seen our servants and are confused by them. "Where is their music?" Clade will often ask me. I do not know what he means. But our servants do not react to the Parshendi at all, showing no interest in emulating them. This is reassuring. The question about music may have to do with the humming and chanting the Parshendi often do. They have an uncanny ability to make music together. I swear that I have left one Parshendi singing to himself, then soon passed another out of earshot of the first, yet singing the very same song, eerily near to the other in tempo, tune, and lyric. Their favorite instrument is the drum. They are crudely made, with handprints of paint marking the sides. This matches their simple buildings, which they construct of creme and stone. They build them in the crater-like rock formations here at the edge of the shattered plains. I ask Clade if they worry about high storms, but he just laughs. Why worry? If the buildings blow down, we can build them again, can we not? On the other side of the alcove, Yasna's book rustled as she turned a page. Shallan set aside her own volume, then picked through the books on the desk. Her philosophy training done for the time being, she had returned to her study of King Gavilar's murder. She slid a small volume out from the bottom of the stack. A record, dictated by Storm Warden Matane, one of the scholars who had accompanied the king. Shallan flipped through the pages, searching for a specific passage. It was a description of the very first Parshendi hunting party they encountered. It happened after we set up beside a deep river in a heavily wooded area. It was an ideal location for a long-term camp, as the dense cobwood trees would protect against high storm winds, and the river's gorge eliminated the risk of flooding. His Majesty wisely took my advice, sending scouting parties both upriver and down. High Prince Dalinar's scouting party was the first to encounter the strange, untamed Parshmen. When he returned to camp with his story, I, like many others, refused to believe his claims. Surely Bright Lord Dalinar had simply run across the Parshmen servants of another expedition like our own. Once they visited our camp the next day, their reality could no longer be denied. There were 10 of them, Parshmen to be sure, but bigger than the familiar ones. Some had skin marbled black and red, and others were marbled white and red, as is more common in Alethkar. They carried magnificent weapons, the bright steel etched with complex decorations, but wore simple clothing of woven narbin cloth. Before long, His Majesty became fascinated by these strange Parshmen, insisting that I begin a study of their language and society. I'll admit that my original intent was to expose them as a hoax of some kind. The more we learned, however, the more I came to realize how faulty my original assessment had been. Shallan tapped the page, thinking. Then she pulled out a thick volume, titled King Gavilar Colin, a biography, published by Gavilar's widow, Navani, 2 years before. Shallan flipped through pages, scanning for a particular paragraph. "My husband was an excellent king, an inspiring leader, an unparalleled duelist, and a genius of battlefield tactics. But he didn't have a single scholarly finger on his left hand. He never showed an interest in the accounting of high storms, was bored by talk of science, and ignored fabrials unless they had an obvious use in battle. He was a man built after the classical masculine ideal. "Why was he so interested in them?" Shallan said out loud. "Hmm?" Yasna asked. "King Gavilar," Shallan said. "Your mother insists in her biography that he wasn't a scholar." "True. But he was interested in the Parshendi," Shallan said, "even before he could have known about their shard blades. According to Matane's account, he wanted to know about their language, their society, and their music. Was that just embellishment? To make him sound more scholarly to future readers?" "No," Yasna said, lowering her own book. "The longer he remained in the unclaimed hills, the more fascinated by the Parshendi he became." "So there's a discrepancy. Why would a man with no prior interest in scholarship suddenly become so obsessed?" "Yes," Yasna said. "I too have wondered about this. But sometimes people change. When he returned, I was encouraged by his interest. We spent many evenings talking about his discoveries. It was one of the few times when I felt I really connected with my father." Shallan bit her lip. "Yasna," she finally asked, "why did you assign me to research this event? You lived through this. You already know everything I'm discovering." "I feel a fresh perspective may be of value." Yasna put down her book, looking over at Shallan. "I don't intend for you to find specific answers. Instead, I hope that you will notice details I've missed. You are coming to see how my father's personality changed during those months, and that means you are digging deeply. Believe it or not, few others have caught the discrepancy you just did, though many do note his later changes, once he returned to Kolinar." "Even so, I feel a little odd studying it. Perhaps I'm still influenced by my tutor's idea that only the classics are a proper realm of study for young ladies. The classics do have their place, and I will send you to classical works on occasion, as I did with your study of morality. But I intend such tangents to be adjuncts to your current projects. Those must be the focus, not long-lost historical conundrums." Shallan nodded. "But Yasna, aren't you a historian? Aren't those long-lost historical conundrums the meat of your field?" "I'm a Veristatalian," Yasna said. "We search for answers in the past, reconstructing what truly happened. To many, writing a history is not about truth, but about presenting the most flattering picture of themselves and their motives. My sisters and I choose projects that we feel were misunderstood or misrepresented, and in studying them, hope to better understand the present." "Why, then, are you spending so much time studying folk tales and looking for evil spirits?" "No. Yasna was searching for something real, something so important that it drew her away from the shattered plains and the fight to avenge her father. She intended to do something with those folk tales, and Shallan's research was part of it somehow. That excited her. It was the sort of thing she'd wanted since she'd been a child, looking through her father's few books, frustrated that he'd chased off yet another tutor. Here, with Yasna, Shallan was part of something, and knowing Yasna, it was something big. And yet, she thought, Tozbek's ship arrives tomorrow morning. I'll be leaving. I need to start complaining. I need to convince Yasna that this was all so much harder than I anticipated, so that when I leave, she won't be surprised. I need to cry, break down, give up. I need to... What is Urethiru? Shallan found herself asking instead. To her surprise, Yasna answered without hesitation. Urethiru was said to be the center of the Silver Kingdoms, a city that held 10 thrones, one for each king. It was the most majestic, most amazing, most important city in all the world. Really? Why hadn't I heard of it before? because it was abandoned even before the lost radiance turned against mankind. Most scholars consider it just a myth. The Ardents refuse to speak of it, due to its association with the Radiance, and therefore with the first major failure of Voronism. Much of what we know about the city comes from fragments of lost works, quoted by classical scholars. Many of those classical works have themselves survived only in pieces. Indeed, the single complete work we have from early years is The Way of Kings, and that is only because of the Vanriel's efforts. Shallan nodded slowly. If there were ruins of a magnificent ancient city hidden somewhere, Natanatan, unexplored, overgrown, wild, would be the natural place to find them. Urethiru is not in Natanatan, Yasna said, smiling. But it is a good guess, Shallan. Return to your studies. The weapons, Shallan said. Yasna raised an eyebrow. The Parshendi. They carried beautiful weapons of fine, etched steel. Yet they used skin drums with crude handprints on the sides and lived in huts of stone and creme. Doesn't that strike you as incongruous? Yes, I would certainly describe that as an oddity. Then I assure you, Shallan, Yasna said, the city is not there. But you are interested in the Shattered Plains. You spoke of them with Bright Lord Dalinar through the span reed. I did. What were the Voidbringers? Now that Yasna was actually answering, perhaps she'd say. What were they, really? Yasna studied her with a curious expression. Nobody knows for sure. Most scholars consider them, like Urethiru, mere myths, while theologians accept them as counterparts of the Almighty, monsters that dwelled in the hearts of men, much as the Almighty once lived there. But return to your studies, child, Yasna said, raising her book. Perhaps we will speak of this another time. There was an air of finality about that. Shallan bit her lip, keeping herself from saying something rude just to draw Yasna back into conversation. She doesn't trust me, she thought. Perhaps with good reason. You're leaving, Shallan told herself again. Tomorrow, you're sailing away from this. But that meant she had only one day left. One more day in the Grand Palinaeum. One more day with all of these books, all of this power and knowledge. I need a copy of Tifandor's biography of your father, Shallan said, poking through the books. I keep seeing it referenced. It's on one of the bottom floors, Yasna said idly. I might be able to dig out the index number. No need, Shallan said, standing. I'll look it up. I need the practice. As you wish, Yasna said. Shallan smiled. She knew exactly where the book was, but the pretense of searching for it would give her time away from Yasna. And during that time, she'd see what she could discover about the Voidbringers on her own. 2 hours later, Shallan sat at a cluttered desk at the back of one of the Palinaeum's lower-level rooms, her sphere lantern illuminating a stack of hastily gathered volumes, none of which had proven much use. It seemed that everybody knew something about the Voidbringers. People in rural areas spoke of them as mysterious creatures that came out at night, stealing from the unlucky and punishing the foolish. Those Voidbringers seemed more mischievous than evil. But then there would be the odd story about a Voidbringer taking on the form of a wayward traveler who, after receiving kindness from a Talu farmer, would slaughter the entire family, drink their blood, then write voidish symbols across the walls in black ash. Most people in the cities, however, saw the Voidbringers as spirits who stalked at night, a kind of evil spren that invaded the hearts of men and made them do terrible things. When a good man grew angry, it was the work of a Voidbringer. Scholars laughed at all these ideas. Actual historical accounts, the ones she could find quickly, were contradictory. Were the Voidbringers the denizens of damnation? If so, wouldn't damnation now be empty, as the Voidbringers had conquered the Tranquiline Halls and cast out mankind to Roshar? I should have known that I'd have trouble finding anything solid, Shallan thought, leaning back in her chair. Yasna's been researching this for months, maybe years. What did I expect to find in a few hours? The only thing the research had done was increase her confusion. What errant winds had brought Yasna to this topic? It made no sense. Studying the Voidbringers was like trying to determine if Death's Spren were real or not. What was the point? She shook her head, stacking her books. The Ardents would reshelve them for her. She needed to fetch Tiffandor's biography and return to their balcony. She rose and walked toward the room's exit, carrying her lantern in her free hand. She hadn't brought a parchment. She intended to carry back only the one book. As she reached the exit, she noticed another light approaching out on the balcony. Just before she arrived, someone stepped up to the doorway, holding aloft a garnet lantern. "Capsule?" Shallan asked, surprised to see his youthful face, painted blue by the light. "Shallan?" he asked, looking up at the index inscription atop the entryway. "What are you doing here?" "Yasna said you were looking for Tiffandor."
"I got turned around."
He raised an eyebrow at her.
"Bad lie?" she asked.
"Terrible," he said. "You're two floors up and about 1,000 index numbers off. After I couldn't find you below, I asked the lift porters to take me where they brought you, and they took me here."
"Yasna's training can be exhausting," Shallan said. "So I sometimes find a quiet corner to relax and compose myself. It's the only time I get to be alone."
Capsule nodded thoughtfully.
"Better?" she asked.
"Still problematic. You took a break. But for 2 hours? Besides, I remember you telling me that Yasna's training wasn't so terrible."
"She'd believe me," Shallan said. "She thinks she's far more demanding than she is, or... well, she is demanding. I just don't mind as much as she thinks I do."
"Very well," he said. "But what were you doing down here, then?"
She bit her lip, causing him to laugh.
"What?" she demanded, blushing. "You just look so blasted innocent when you do that."
"I am innocent."
"Didn't you just lie to me twice in a row?"
"Innocent as in the opposite of sophisticated," she grimaced. "Otherwise they'd have been more convincing lies. Come, walk with me while I fetch Tiffandor. If we hurry, I won't have to lie to Yasna."
"Fair enough," he said, joining her and strolling around the perimeter of the Palinaeum.
The hollow, inverted pyramid rose toward the ceiling far above, the four walls expanding outward at a slant. The topmost levels were brighter and easier to make out, tiny lights bobbing along railings in the hands of ardents or scholars.
57 levels, Shallan said. "I can't even imagine how much work it must have been for you to create all this."
"We didn't create it," Capsule said. "It was here. The main shaft, at least. The Carbranthians cut out the rooms for the books."
"This formation is natural?"
"As natural as cities like Kolinar. Or have you forgotten my demonstration?"
"No. But why didn't you use this place as one of your examples?"
"We haven't found the right sand pattern yet," he said. "But we're sure the Almighty himself made this place, as he did the cities."
"What about the Dawn Singers?" Shallan asked.
"What about them?"
"Could they have created it?"
He chuckled as they arrived at the lift.
"That isn't the kind of thing the Dawn Singers did. They were healers, kindly spren sent by the Almighty to care for humans once we were forced out of the Tranquiline Halls."
"Kind of like the opposite of the Voidbringers."
"I suppose you could say that."
"Take us down 2 levels, she told the parchment lift porters. They began lowering the platform, the pulleys squeaking and wood shaking beneath her feet.
"If you think to distract me with this conversation," Capsule noted, folding his arms and leaning back against the railing, "you won't be successful. I sat up there with your disapproving mistress for well over an hour, and let me say that it was not a pleasant experience. I think she knows I still intend to try and convert her."
"Of course she does. She's Yasna," She knows practically everything.
Except whatever it is she came here to study.
The Voidbringers, Shallan said. That's what she's studying. He frowned. A few moments later, the lift came to a rest on the appropriate floor. The Voidbringers? He said, sounding curious. She'd have expected him to be scornful or amused. No, she thought. He's an ardent. He believes in them. What were they? She asked, walking out. Not far below, the massive cavern came to a point. There was a large, infused diamond there, marking the nadir.
We don't like to talk about it, Capsule said as he joined her.
Why not? You're an ardent. This is part of your religion.
An unpopular part.
People prefer to hear about the 10 divine attributes or the 10 human failings. We accommodate them because we also prefer that to the deep past.
Because? She prodded.
Because, he said with a sigh, of our failure. Shallan, the devotaries at their core are still classical Voronism. That means the hierocracy and the fall of the Lost Radiance are our shame.
He held up his deep blue lantern.
Shallan strolled at his side, curious, letting him just talk. We believe that the Voidbringers were real, Shallan. A scourge and a plague. 100 times they came upon mankind, first casting us from the Tranquiline Halls, then trying to destroy us here on Roshar. They weren't just Spren that hid under rocks, then came out to steal someone's laundry. They were creatures of terrible destructive power, forged in damnation, created from hate.
By whom? Shallan asked.
What?
Who made them?
I mean, the Almighty wasn't likely to have created something from hate. So what made them?
Everything has its opposite, Shallan. The Almighty is a force of good. To balance his goodness, the Cosmere needed the Voidbringers as his opposite.
So the more good that the Almighty did, the more evil he created as a byproduct? What's the point of doing any good at all if it just creates more evil?
I see Yasna has continued your training in philosophy.
That's not philosophy, Shallan said. That's simple logic.
He sighed. I don't think you want to get into the deep theology of this. Suffice it to say that the Almighty's pure goodness created the Voidbringers. But men may choose good without creating evil, because as mortals they have a dual nature. Thus, the only way for good to increase in the Cosmere is for men to create it. In that way, good may come to outweigh evil.
All right, she said. But I don't buy the explanation about the Voidbringers.
I thought you were a believer.
I am. But just because I honor the Almighty doesn't mean I'm going to accept any explanation, Capsule. It might be religion, but it still has to make sense.
Didn't you once tell me that you didn't understand your own self?
Well, yes.
And yet you expect to be able to understand the exact workings of the Almighty?
She drew her lips into a line. All right, fine. But I still want to know more about the Voidbringers. He shrugged as she guided him into an archive room filled with shelves of books.
I told you the basics, Shallan. The Voidbringers were an embodiment of evil. We fought them off 99 times, led by the heralds and their chosen knights, the 10 orders we call the Knights Radiant. Finally, Ahar-Yet-Yam came, the last desolation. The Voidbringers were cast back into the Tranquiline Halls. The heralds followed to force them out of heaven as well, and Roshar's heraldic epochs ended. Mankind entered the era of solitude, the modern era.
But why is everything from before so fragmented?
This was thousands and thousands of years ago, Shallan, Capsule said. Before history, before men even knew how to forge steel. We had to be given shard blades, otherwise we would have had to fight the Voidbringers with clubs.
And yet we had the Silver Kingdoms and the Knights Radiant,
formed and led by the heralds.
Shallan frowned, counting off rows of shelves. She stopped at the correct one, handed her lantern to Capsule, then walked down the aisle and plucked the biography off the shelf. Capsule followed her, holding up the lanterns.
"There's more to this," Shallan said. "Otherwise, Yasna wouldn't be digging so hard."
"I can tell you why she's doing it," he said.
Shallan glanced at him.
"Don't you see?" he said. "She's trying to prove that the Voidbringers weren't real. She wants to demonstrate that this was all a fabrication of the Radiance."
He stepped forward and turned to face her, the lantern light rebounding from the books to either side, making his face pale.
"She wants to prove once and for all that the Devotaries and Voronism are a gigantic fraud. That's what this is all about."
"Maybe," Shallan said thoughtfully. It did seem to fit. What better goal for an avowed heretic? Undermining foolish beliefs and disproving religion? It explained why Yasna would study something as seemingly inconsequential as the Voidbringers. Find the right evidence in the historical records, and Yasna might well be able to prove herself right.
"Haven't we been scourged enough?" Capsule said, eyes angry. "The Ardents are no threat to her. We're not a threat to anyone these days. We can't own property. Damnation, we're property ourselves. We dance to the whims of the city lords and warlords, afraid to tell them the truths of their sins for fear of retribution. We're white spines without tusks or claws, expected to sit at our master's feet and offer praise. Yet this is real. It's all real, and they ignore us and—"
He cut off suddenly, glancing at her, lips tight, jaw clenched. She'd never seen such fervor, such fury from the Pleasant Ardent. She wouldn't have thought him capable of it.
"I'm sorry," he said, turning from her, leading the way back down the aisle.
"It's all right," she said, hurrying after him, suddenly feeling depressed. Shallan had expected to find something grander, something more mysterious behind Yasna's secretive research. Could it all really just be about proving Voronism false?
They walked in silence out to the balcony, and there she realized she had to tell him.
"Capsule, I'm leaving."
He looked at her, surprised.
"I've had news from my family," she said. "I can't speak of it, but I can stay no longer."
"Something about your father?"
"Why, have you heard something?"
"Only that he's been reclusive lately. More than normal."
She suppressed a flinch. News had gotten this far?
"I'm sorry to go so suddenly."
"You'll return?"
"I don't know."
He looked into her eyes, searching.
"Do you know when you'll be leaving?" he said in a suddenly cool voice.
"Tomorrow morning."
"Well then," he said, "will you at least do me the honor of sketching me? You've never given me a likeness, though you've done many of the other Ardents."
She started, realizing that was true. Despite their time together, she'd never done a sketch of Capsule. She raised her free hand to her mouth.
"I'm sorry."
He seemed taken aback.
"I didn't mean it bitterly, Shallan. It's really not that important."
"Yes, it is," she said, grabbing his hand, towing him along the walkway. "I left my drawing things up above. Come on."
She hurried him to the lift, instructing the parchment to carry them up. As the lift began to rise, Capsule looked at her hand in his. She dropped it hastily.
"You're a very confusing woman," he said stiffly.
"I warned you."
She held the retrieved book close to her breast.
"I believe you said you had me figured out."
"I rescind that statement."
He looked at her.
"You're really leaving?"
She nodded.
"I'm sorry. Capsule, I'm not what you think I am."
"I think you're a beautiful, intelligent woman."
"Well, you have the woman part right."
"Your father is sick, isn't he?"
She didn't answer.
"I can see why you'd want to return to be with him," Capsule said. "But surely you won't abandon your wardship forever. You'll be back with Yasna."
"And she won't be staying in Carbranth forever. She's been moving from place to place almost constantly for the last 2 years. He looked ahead, staring out the front of the lift as they rose. Soon they had to transfer to another lift to carry them up the next group of floors.
I shouldn't have been spending time with you, he finally said. The senior Ardents think I'm too distracted. They never like it when one of us starts looking outside the Ardentia.
Your right to court is protected.
We're property. A man's rights can be protected at the same time that he is discouraged from exercising them. I've avoided work, I've disobeyed my superiors. In courting you, I've also courted trouble.
I didn't ask you for any of that.
You didn't discourage me.
She had no response for that, other than to feel a rising worry, a hint of panic, a desire to run away and hide. During her years of near solitude on her father's estate, she had never dreamed of a relationship like this one. Is that what this is? She thought, panic swelling. A relationship? Her intentions in coming to Carbranth had seemed so straightforward. How had she gotten to the point where she risked breaking a man's heart? And, to her shame, she admitted to herself that she would miss the research more than Capsule. Was she a horrible person for feeling that way? She was fond of him. He was pleasant. Interesting. He looked at her, and there was longing in his eyes. He seemed... Stormfather, he seemed to really be in love with her. Shouldn't she be falling in love with him, too? She didn't think she was. She was just confused. When they reached the top of the Palineum's system of lifts, she practically ran out into the Vale. Capsule followed, but they needed another lift up to Yasna's alcove, and soon she found herself trapped with him once more.
I could come, Capsule said softly. Return with you to Yakaved.
Shallan's panic increased. She barely knew him. Yes, they had chatted frequently, but rarely about the important things. If he left the Ardentia, he'd be demoted to 10th Dan, almost as low as a Dark Eyes. He'd be without money or house, in almost as bad a position as her family. Her family? What would her brothers say if she brought a virtual stranger back with her? Another man to become part of their problems, privy to their secrets.
I can see from your expression that it's not an option, Capsule said. It seems that I've misinterpreted some very important things.
No, it's not that, Shallan said quickly. It's just... Oh, Capsule, how can you expect to make sense of my actions when even I can't make sense of them?
She touched his arm, turning him toward her.
I have been dishonest with you, and with Yasna, and most infuriatingly with myself. I'm sorry.
He shrugged, obviously trying to feign nonchalance. At least I'll get a sketch, won't I?
She nodded as the lift finally shuddered to a halt. She walked down the dark hallway, Capsule following with the lanterns. Yasna looked up appraisingly as Shallan entered their alcove, but did not ask why she'd taken so long. Shallan found herself blushing as she gathered her drawing tools. Capsule hesitated in the doorway. He'd left a basket of bread and jam on the desk. The top of it was still wrapped with a cloth. Yasna hadn't touched it, though he always offered her some as a peace offering. Without jam, since Yasna hated it.
Where should I sit? Capsule asked.
Just stand there, Shallan said, sitting down, propping her sketch pad against her legs and holding it still with her covered safe hand. She looked up at him, leaning with one hand against the doorframe. Head shaved, light gray robe draped around him, sleeves short, waist tied with a white sash, eyes confused. She blinked, taking a memory, then began to sketch. It was one of the most awkward experiences of her life. She didn't tell Capsule that he could move, and so he held the pose. He didn't speak. Perhaps he thought it would spoil the picture. Shallan found her hand shaking as she sketched, though thankfully she managed to hold back tears. Tears, she thought, doing the final lines of the wall around Capsule. Why should I cry? I'm not the one who just got rejected. Can't my emotions make sense once in a while? Here, she said, pulling the page free and holding it up. It will smudge unless you spray it with lacquer. Capsule hesitated, then walked over, taking the picture in reverent fingers. It's wonderful, he whispered. He looked up, then hurried to his lantern, opening it and pulling out the garnet brome inside. Here, he said, proffering it. Payment. I can't take that. For one thing, it's not yours. As an ardent, anything Capsule carried would belong to the king. Please, Capsule said. I want to give you something. The picture is a gift, she said. If you pay me for it, then I haven't given you anything. Then I'll commission another, he said, pressing the glowing sphere into her fingers. I'll take the first likeness for free, but do another for me, please. One of the two of us together. She paused. She rarely did sketches of herself. They felt strange to draw. All right. She took the sphere, then furtively tucked it into her safe pouch beside her soul caster. It was a little odd to carry something so heavy there, but she'd gotten accustomed to the bulge and weight. Yasna, do you have a mirror? She asked. The other woman sighed audibly, obviously annoyed by the distraction. She felt through her things, taking out a mirror. Capsule fetched it. Hold it up beside your head, Shallan said, so I can see myself. He walked back over, doing so, looking confused. Angle it to the side a little, Shallan said. All right, there. She blinked, freezing in her mind the image of her face beside his. Have a seat. You don't need the mirror any longer. I just wanted it for reference. It helps me, for some reason, to place my features into the scene I want to sketch. I'll put myself sitting beside you. He sat on the floor and Shallan began to work, using it to distract herself from her conflicting emotions. Guilt at not feeling as strongly for Capsule as he did for her, yet sorrow that she wouldn't be seeing him anymore. And above it all, anxiety about the soul caster. Sketching herself in beside him was challenging. She worked furiously, blending the reality of Capsule sitting and a fiction of herself in her flower-embroidered dress sitting with her legs to the side. The face in the mirror became her reference point, and she built her head around it. Too narrow to be beautiful, with hair too light, cheeks dotted with freckles. The soul caster, she thought. Being here in Carbranth with it is a danger, but leaving is dangerous too. Could there be a third option? What if I sent it away? She hesitated, charcoal pencil hovering above the picture. Dared she send the fabrial, packaged, delivered to Tozbek in secret, back to Yakoved without her? She wouldn't have to worry about being incriminated if her room or person were searched, though she'd want to destroy all pictures she'd drawn of Yasna with the soul caster. And she wouldn't risk suspicion by vanishing near when Yasna discovered her soul caster didn't work. She continued her drawing, increasingly withdrawn into her thoughts, letting her fingers work. If she sent the soul caster back alone, then she could stay in Carbranth. It was a golden, tempting prospect, but one that threw her emotions further into a jumbled mess. She'd been preparing herself to leave for so long. What could she do about Capsule? And Yasna? Could Shallan really remain here, accepting Yasna's freely given tutelage after what she'd done? Yes, Shallan thought. Yes, I could. The fervency of that emotion surprised her. She would live with the guilt, day by day, if it meant continuing to learn. It was terribly selfish of her, and she was ashamed of it. But she would do it for a little longer, at least. She'd have to go back eventually, of course. She couldn't leave her brothers to face danger alone. They needed her. Selfishness, followed by courage. She was nearly as surprised by the latter as she had been by the former. Neither was something she often associated with who she was. But she was coming to realize that she hadn't known who she was. Not until she left Yakoved and everything familiar, everything she'd been expected to be.
Her sketching grew more and more fervent. She finished the figures and moved to the background. Quick, bold lines became the floor and the archway behind. A scribbled dark smudge for the side of the desk, casting a shadow. Crisp, thin lines for the lantern sitting on the floor. Sweeping, breeze-like lines to form the legs and robes of the creature standing behind. Shallan froze, fingers drawing an unintended line of charcoal, breaking away from the figure she'd sketched directly behind Capsule. A figure that wasn't really there. A figure with a sharp, angular symbol hovering above its collar instead of a head. Shallan stood, throwing back her chair, sketchpad and charcoal pencil clutched in the fingers of her free hand. "Shallan," Capsule said, standing. She'd done it again. Why? The peace she'd begun to feel during the sketching evaporated in a heartbeat, and her heart started to race. The pressures returned. Capsule, Yasna, her brothers. Decisions, choices, problems. "Is everything all right?" Capsule said, taking a step toward her. "I'm sorry," she said. I made a mistake." He frowned. To the right, Yasna looked up, brow wrinkled. "It's all right," Capsule said. "Look, let's have some bread and jam. We can calm down, then you could finish it." "I don't care about it. I need to go," Shallan cut in, feeling suffocated. "I'm sorry." She brushed past the dumbfounded Ardent, hurrying from the alcove, giving a wide berth to the place where the figure stood in her sketch. What was wrong with her? She rushed to the lift, calling for the parchment to lower her. She glanced over her shoulder. Capsule stood in the hallway looking after her. Shallan reached the lift, drawing pad clutched in her hand, her heart racing. "Calm yourself," she thought, leaning back against the lift platform's wooden railing as the parchment began to take her down. She looked up at the empty landing above her and found herself blinking, memorizing that scene. She began sketching again. She drew with concise motions, sketch pad held against her safe arm. For illumination, she had just two very small spheres at either side where the taut ropes quivered. She moved without thought, just drawing, staring upward.